Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Today, we celebrate a key American cultural export, stand-up comedy. It thrives even in places like Ukraine, with missiles flying overhead.
Sometimes missiles are late, and Ukrainians become angry, like, where's this Russian missiles?
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. This 4th of July, we dedicate our show to people around the world making others laugh in places without comedy clubs.
There was no comedy in Zimbabwe at all.
And about topics like climate change that are generally pretty unfunny.
When you're in a hole, stop digging. That's the proverb. Not dig even more to maximize profits until the whole planet is doomed and you can go live in your bunker.
Comedy across the globe.
That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in and making us part of your 4th of July holiday.
Let's say you're making a list of American cultural exports. Fast food might come to mind.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac.
That's from Pulp Fiction. There's also baseball. That's called America's pastime, even though the sport has been hugely popular in places like Japan and Cuba for almost 100 years.
The U.S. has left its cultural fingerprints all over the globe in countless ways. And today, we're making the case for stand-up comedy as an important cultural export. Right now, there's a whole new crop of stand-up comics stepping into the spotlight in other countries. And some of them are coming here to make it big in the U.S. This holiday special is all about them. Not just the comics themselves, but also the circumstances that inspire their jokes. We begin with a guy we talked to in December. His name is Learnmore Genasi, and he's from Zimbabwe.
When I first came to America, I saw something I didn't know existed. I saw poor white people. What? How is this possible? This white guy was like, can I have a dollar?
Learnmore Genasi moved to the U.S. in 2021. We caught up with Learnmore in Pittsburgh, where he lives. Learnmore, great to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Now, I want to get to your name first, Learnmore. Yeah. It's just like it sounds. It's your given name. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so my name is Learnmore. It's because Zimbabweans, we just give our kids names like this. It's a very Zimbabwean tradition. It's because Zimbabwe is a British colony. So back then, it was a great idea to give your child an English name. You know, but black people start going crazy with it and naming their kids names like learn more, give more, talk more, you know?
Now, talk to me about where you grew up. You're from a small village in Zimbabwe. What was it like?
I grew up in a small village. It's called Chimanimani. Most people, when I tell them that I come from a village, they expect me to talk about how bad my childhood was. But I had the most amazing childhood. Like, I had space. I had, you know, just the family that, you know, that loved me and just community. It was so beautiful.
So how did you discover stand-up comedy?
Well, it was this particular day when my grandfather was actually worried on where he's going to get some money to, you know, to feed us. So then he was worried, he was stressed, and then he turned on the TV and there was comedy on TV and he started laughing. And I just thought to myself, I want to be able to do that, you know, at a very young age. And I started mimicking that. That's when the dream started.
So who was that comedian at that point? Was it a Zimbabwean comedian?
No, there was no comedy in Zimbabwe at all. So it was Roy Atkinson. He used to do this character called Mr. Bean. You know,
yes.
Yeah, and that's why my comedy is so physical, because of that.
Huh. So what other comedians did you listen to once you got the bug that made you think, I really want to do that?
So I went straight into a rabbit hole where I was just searching for comedy and what, you know, the different forms of comedy. And then stand-up comedy, just fell in love with it as soon as I watched Richard Pryor and then Eddie Murphy. And then I watched Trevor Noah at some point. That's when I was like, an African can do it, so I can do it too, you know? So that's when I just started falling in love with stand-up comedy.
So how did you get your start? I mean, if there wasn't much stand-up comedy in Zimbabwe, how did you go about it?
Well, I just kind of like went on Facebook. Facebook was so new in my country at that time. And there was a comedy show that was happening at a local comedy club in the capital city of Zimbabwe, Harare. So I traveled from Chimanimani to Harare to try and do a 5-minute spot at that comedy club. And it was horrible. I got booed on stage. Like a guy threw a chair on stage while I was performing. It was that bad.
Wow.
Because what was funny in my village was not funny in the capital city. So I had to learn just like that.
Aha. That's an early valuable lesson, isn't it?
Yeah. And I've kind of used it in my career because I come from Zimbabwe and then I moved to America. Again, what was funny in Zimbabwe was not funny in America. So I had to use the same principles I've learned when I moved to America.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting because some of your jokes that you use in comedy clubs in the U.S., they play on the fact that you're an immigrant.
I'm sorry. Is it the air conditioning? Are you in a relationship?
No. Okay.
I got my green card now, so this time it's for love.
So, that's a classic. A lot of your comedy is very observational, you know, from the perspective of someone who's been influenced by American popular culture, but is now here in the U.S. to give us a reality check.
Listen, I've been learning a lot about American culture by watching American movies. And I've noticed every time when America makes a movie about Africa, it doesn't make sense to Africans. Yeah, I was watching The Lion King the other day. I was like, why do these lions have American accents? And they're like, in Africa? And here's the messed up part. The only animal they gave an accent was the monkey. What? Yeah, and it was Caribbean. What is this? What kind of Africa is this, you know? But I'll give them this, though. The only accent that made sense to me as an African was Scar's accent. Because he was British and he wanted land. I was like, ha-ha! That sounds very familiar.
Now, that clip was from one of your performances on America's Got Talent.
Yes.
And you made it to the finals of that show.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
Oh, my God. That was such... Even till today, I still can't believe I made it to the finals. It still feels like a dream because it opened so many doors.
Yes, and as I understand it, comedians don't usually do well on America's Got Talent.
Yeah, yes. It's so tough. It's such a tough competition for comedians because you're performing after like a spectacle, like a band with lights, you know, and just different musicians and just, you know, and then you go there with your jokes. So it's a different art form, you know.
I want to play another clip from your performance on America's Got Talent. It's a cultural comment on Americans and their dogs.
Okay. It's crazy. The other day I was just taking a walk, enjoying my day. Then I saw a dog in a stroller. Yeah, it was just chilling right there, enjoying its life. And the lady was like, so this is my dog. His name is Mozzarella. He's like a rescue, but I like to think he rescued me. Do you have a dog? I was like, yeah, I have a dog in Zimbabwe. What breed is it? I was like, I think mine is just brown. Yeah, I think that's the name of the breed, brown dog. And then she's like, can I see a photo? Can I see a photo of your dog? I don't have a photo of my dog. Because my dog is an employee. Yeah, it works for me. It hunts for us. It protects us, security. Do you think Simon Cowell has pictures of his employees on his phone?
And of course, that got a roar because Simon Cowell is one of the judges.
Yes, yeah.
I'm wondering if part of your goal as a Zimbabwean comedian here, observing Americans, is to get Americans to reflect back on themselves and on things they make take for granted.
It's not just Americans. It's the whole world, because the perception of the whole world on America is different with reality. So I think for me, I fit in between there to kind of like keep people in check and say, hey, no. It's like this here. Oh, hey, it's like this there. So yeah, that's what I think.
That conversation with Learn More Genasi took place in December, and now he's on tour with shows in the U.S. this summer and fall.
Comedy does not disappear when times get tough. It can even become a refuge during war. It didn't take long after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine for Ukrainian comic Anton Timoshenko to start performing again. But his shows in Kyiv had to be in bomb shelters.
This is our comedy cellar in Ukraine. It's really easy to find audience for stand-up because you just come and people hear.
That is from his very first wartime gig. It was also his first performance in English. As The World's Daniel Offman reported this spring, that's because the audience Timoshenko was trying to reach was a global audience.
One of the benefits of living near Russia is that you always live in a moment, you know? Always live in a moment, because we might have only a moment to live in Ukraine. People around the world try to find this way how to live in a moment. They try this mindfulness meditation, fly to Thailand or to Bali. Stop it. Just come to Ukraine.
Timoshenko says that he and some of his comedian friends were among the first people to perform in Ukraine in any genre after the full-scale invasion. He says stand-up is an easy show to set up. You don't need much, just a comedian and a microphone.
This first shows after full-scale invasion were amazing. People laugh so hard because they have so much tension in their minds and body. And when they get this relief, it was amazing.
But as the war with Russia dragged on, figuring out wartime stand-up became tricky. In Ukraine, the war impacts everyone. However, there's a wide spectrum of how it's altered people's lives. Some people lost loved ones, some have been displaced, others are coping with trauma and fear.
Also, like soldiers, they have their own sense of humor. It's pretty darker, but you never know as a civilian guy, could you or not, you know, cross this line.
Another challenge that Timoshenko has taken on is performing for an international audience. Last year, he traveled to the U.S. and Europe as part of a fundraising tour for Ukraine.
My goal was to perform in front of Americans who don't know me at all and check, can I make them laugh? And it was a successful mission, not from the first performance, but in my last two shows, it was amazing. I was like, yes, I know how to do it.
In Ukraine, we have this schedule sharing. Like, we have an app, you can go to app and see information like, Russian missiles are going from the Black Sea. Arrival time, 1 p.m. That's true. And sometimes these missiles are late, and Ukrainians become angry, like, where's this Russian missiles? I have some plans after shelling today, so come on.
Outside of Ukraine, Timoshenko says it takes longer for audiences to warm up to this type of dark humor.
People feel uncomfortable to laugh about your tragedy, and probably that's good. Like for the stand-up show, it's not good, but generally, like for mankind, it's okay that people will not laugh from your tragedy so hard in your face.
Timoshenko says he views his comedy as being part of a bigger mission. He says that raising money for Ukraine's armed forces motivates him, along with giving people a break from thinking about the war.
This is your defensive mechanism. When you start to joke about death, to not be afraid of this death so much, or you joke about your enemies, to get brave from somewhere. Like when you're joking about something, you're afraid less of death.
Timoshenko says that in the future, he hopes to write jokes that have nothing to do with war, to experiment and be more creative with his stand-up. For now, though, he says his humor reflects the world around him, even if the jokes that come out are dark and uncomfortable. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Ahead on today's show, the role of comedy in a country where people are learning to use their newfound freedom.
It is our time as stand-up comedians to be the pioneers, to tell people that, yeah, you can talk about that. You can talk about that outside of your private rooms and homes. You can say whatever you want.
The stand-up scene in Syria, that is coming right up on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Today's show is all about stand-up comedy around the world. And we go now to Syria. Since the fall of Bashar al-Assad, artists of all kinds have been testing the limits of what they can express under their new government, despite lingering uncertainty about what's safe and what's not. As The World's Shirin Jafari reported from Damascus this spring, the comedy scene is a big part of that.
It's almost sunset, and a crowd is gathering at the Karma Cafe in central Damascus. Young men and women mingle. Some women are wearing headscarves, others are not. Tonight, three comedians are doing stand-up in a free Syria. They're part of a group called Styria, a play on the words Syria and hysteria.
Because there is a hysterical situation in Syria, so we need hysterical laughter.
Members of Styria consider themselves as Syria's first stand-up comedy troupe. Sharif Homsi is one of the performers tonight. He founded the group 2 years ago with the help of a few friends. Back then, it was a difficult time for comedy, he says. Syria was under the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad.
You know when you're in a coma? Like you're not allowed to die, but you're not allowed to live? Yeah, this is how we were living.
Homsi says he knew he was funny from a young age. He's been writing comedy for about a decade, mostly for himself. Stand-up wasn't a thing in Syria, so he had to go elsewhere to learn the craft. He moved to Dubai in 2016 and took workshops by other Arab comedians. Starting Styria under Assad was a risky move, he says. Assad had turned Syrians against one another. One wrong word and someone could report you. You could disappear in a blink of an eye, Homsi says.
It was really scary because you're doing comedy in a dictatorship that are killing all type of art that is saying something.
Still, Homsi and his friends managed to not only start Styria, but also to push the boundaries.
Basically, we were smart about it. Politics, zero. We cannot say anything. Religion, with stereotypes, you know, not too much deep. And sexual, we were smart about it, really smart.
At the cafe in Damascus, Homsi walks up to the mic and greets the crowd. Then, one by one, he rattles off his jokes. Of course, jokes don't translate well. But later, Homsi gives this explanation.
We asked for freedom for 14 years. But when we had that freedom, we didn't know what to do with it, you know. So it reminds me when the first time you have sex, you don't know what you want to do. Like, I want to kiss her, I want to hold her, I want to... So this is what we did with freedom, you know.
Syrians were so caught off guard with the quick departure of Assad, he says, that they're still figuring out what to do with this newfound freedom. Homsi makes fun of himself, too. He jokes about being frugal. His father makes it into some of his jokes. He's a dog walker. So imagine all the content I get out of that, he says. But the joke that gets the most raised eyebrows among the crowd is the one about the extremist past of the new leader, Ahmad al-Sharaa. Homsi says the red lines are still being drawn, and sometimes that can feel overwhelming.
We're still afraid now. The fear is in us, like we're sick, you know. We need to heal. We need time to heal. But we didn't have that time. Like, poof, regime fall, now we have a new one and we have new fears.
It's not just Homsi who's trying to make sense of this new chapter in Syria. Other comedians performing tonight share his concerns. Amar Daba has been doing stand-up comedy for the past 12 years, but always outside of Syria. He returned in December after the government fell.
It's very exciting, and at the same time, it's very confusing because I don't know their limits.
Daba points out that some of the limits are being set by the audience themselves, not the government. And that's where people like him come in, he says.
It is our time as stand-up comedians to be the pioneers, to tell people that, yeah, you can talk about that. You can talk about that outside of your private rooms and homes. You can say whatever you want, even in the streets.
There is one woman performer tonight, Mary Obeid, stage name Mimi. She says she still avoids talking about politics. Her jokes are more about herself and her personal life. Like, she used to be overweight, she says, and uses comedy as a way to talk about it openly.
This was the biggest problem in my life. And I think every problem, when it's spoken loudly, it's no longer a problem. We can get used to it and make fun of it in a good way, in a comedy way.
And comedy can be healing, she says, for the comedian and the audience. After the show, a man who only gives his first name, Ibrahim, reflects on what he heard.
This is what we need in here. We need to communicate our fears, our taboos, in a healthy way. And this is the best way to discuss those really difficult issues.
The crowd starts to make its way outside. People are smiling. Some are exchanging numbers. Others line up to speak with the comedians. For Sharif Homsi, this is the power of comedy. It can create moments of relief and respite, and it can start conversations that otherwise would not take place.
50, 60 people to 100 sharing a room, laughing about similar thing. If they can laugh together, they can live together.
Syrians have been divided for so long, he says. It's time for that to end. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Damascus, Syria.
Sometimes reality is funny enough to be comedy. That was certainly the case with the story we reported about Daisy.
Oh dear, the page is taking a while to load. What's that? You like want me to check my email?
Sweet, trusting, not tech savvy. She sounds like a phone scammer's dream.
Oh dear, I think I clicked the wrong button.
But sounds can be deceiving. Daisy is a scammer's worst nightmare.
I'm an AI created to waste phone scammers' time.
That's right. Daisy is not a real person. She's a conversational AI created by the British telephone company O2, and she drives scammers insane by wasting their time.
The longer Daisy spends on the phone with fraudsters, the less time they have to target real victims.
So W is then a dot.
Three times W and then dot.
I think your profession is bothering people, right?
I'm just trying to have a little chat.
It's nearly been an hour! For the love of...
Gosh, how time flies.
Daisy doesn't need real-time input from any of her human creators to keep up her end of the conversation. She can talk about her knitting, her pets.
It's showing me a picture of my cat, Fluffy.
It's showing you a picture of your cat, Fluffy.
Stop calling me dear, you stupid...
Got it, dear.
All the while playing on scammers' assumptions about senior citizens and using those assumptions against them.
According to O2, the company behind Daisy, the robo-granny has her own phone number. The company plugged the number into known call lists used by scammers. But Daisy isn't taking just their time. She's also collecting data, like when scammers are most likely to call, the kinds of information they're going after, and the tactics they're using.
No doubt actually helpful, but also just kind of fun, right? To beat scammers at their own game.
You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills with our 4th of July special about global comedy. Ramesh Ranganathan is a British-born comedian whose parents are Sri Lankan. His identity is often part of his routine. Here he is on The Late Late Show with James Corden.
Hello, hello. Very excited to be here. Thank you very much. I realised as I walked out immediately, some of you became concerned. Like, oh God, James has booked a brown comedian. Is he going to be going on about being brown the whole time? Please don't worry. Only about 10% of my stuff is based on me being brown. The other 90% is based on my issues with white people.
When I spoke with him back in January, he was on what he called the Hustle Tour, which was mainly about work-life balance in today's world. And I started out by getting personal about the theme.
Now, how about you? You're a father of three kids on a comedy tour. How's that going?
Great. I mean, I really do have to crank up how difficult it is to my wife when I phone her, because obviously I'm working an hour and a half a night. And she is, you know, she's dealing with three boys that have got a lot of demands.
Now, you grew up in Crawley, a town about 30 miles south of London. How did you get interested in comedy?
What happened was actually when I was a kid, I had no idea that stand-up was a thing. And I really got into Eddie Murphy's films. And I didn't realise that he was a stand-up as well. And then one day I came across Raw, which is his stand-up special where he's in the purple suit, the leather suit. And, you know, the whole concept of one person and a microphone, and that is it, that's the show. I remember just being completely blown away by it and then became obsessed with it. But then I became a teacher. I taught maths, or math as you call it over here. And then I thought I'd start doing stand-up as a hobby. And so it kind of was by accident. I was enjoying teaching. There's another Ramesh that would have spent the rest of his years being a teacher and would have been perfectly happy. I really did love teaching, and I loved kind of working with young people and all of that.
Did comedy come in handy as a math teacher?
Yes. The kids are often so uninterested. I mean, I remember there's a stat. Their age in years is the same as a number of minutes that they're able to pay attention to you for any amount of time. And so often you'd be looking for interesting and funny ways of delivering stuff that's on the face of it quite dry.
So you got between 11 minutes and 18 minutes across.
Yeah, correct. That's exactly right, yeah. 18 minutes max, yeah.
Your humor is often self-deprecating and pretty deadpan. Here's a clip from one of your acts.
Doesn't matter how much hotter the woman is, men have got no idea what they look like. All of my friends, solid fours, right? And they walk around, oh, she's a bit of all right. I have to say to them, do you understand how out of your league that woman is? Do you understand that if you're in a couple with that girl, people would assume that you're a millionaire with a terminal illness? Do you understand?
What does self-deprecation do for you in your comedy sets? Or is it just sort of part of who you are?
I just think it's part of who I am. When you're starting out doing stand-up, you're trying to find what your voice is, throwing everything at the wall, just, you know, trying to find laughs. And then as you get more experience, you start to discover what works for you and what you enjoy writing about. And you know, it turns out just sort of like my own kind of foibles and issues are kind of fertile ground for me, comedy-wise. I mean, one of the problems with being self-deprecating is sometimes the audience will feel sorry for you. You know, when you let them into how you feel about yourself sometimes, or what you think about yourself. The truth is that I just always have been very self-deprecating. I do think it's a form of narcissism.
But stand-up is also incredibly brave. It's just you, a microphone, and a crowd.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what kind of makes it so exciting, really. And, you know, people often say, when you start doing stand-up, when you have a few good gigs, which you often do when you start out, you don't know whether you're a stand-up yet. If you have a terrible gig and you walk off stage going, I need to go and do this again to make that right, that's when you know that stand-up's in your blood, really.
Now, I'm wondering how your parents reacted to you wanting to become a comedian.
They were worried. I was teaching maths, and they saw that as like a really respectable, reliable profession. And so when I told them I was leaving to do comedy, they were worried. I mean, they just didn't see... They couldn't really see how you can make money. For, you know, they just thought it's such a high-risk strategy. And also, you know, my mum, as much as she denies it, does worry a little bit about what the Sri Lankan community or what her friends think. And so they were all going, you know, I can't believe your son was a teacher and now he's leaving you to tell jokes. This is crazy. You know, so she was worried about that. And now I've had this discussion with my mum where when I started doing television in the UK, hosting my own shows and stuff, my mum would say to me, you know, I'm so glad you've made it now. You've made it now. But, you know, the point I made to her is you don't have to be doing TV to... You know, I could be paying my bills from doing stand-up and nobody's heard of me. And that, to me, still is making it. But to my mum, she got that sort of external validation that TV shows are booking her son and stuff like that. So now she's happy. I've done TV shows with her and, you know, she's really comfortable now.
What was it like having her as part of your act?
It was great, you know. We did a show called Asian Provocateur, which was where I went back to Sri Lanka. There's a phrase in the UK that sometimes uses to South Asian people that they're a coconut, which means brown on the outside, white on the inside. I was doing a stand-up routine at the time about my mum calling me a coconut because she felt like I didn't know enough about my Sri Lankan heritage. We filmed with mum, and so when the show went out, she was just a breakout star of that show. People were just going mad for her. When we were promoting that show, in front of a studio audience, she still stole the show. And then I thought, okay, I've created a monster.
That was Ramesh Ranganathan speaking with me during his Hustle tour over the winter. Lately, he's been touring Europe with a podcast he co-hosts called The Wolf and Owl. He's also out with a children's book called Lil Muffin Drops the Mic.
The essence of comedy is free speech, so it should come as no surprise that stand-up comedy does not exactly thrive in autocracies. The occasional approved court jester, sure, but a vibrant stand-up scene? Not so much. Which is why the repression of President Nicolas Maduro has sent Venezuelan humor into exile. The world's Tibi Saizea reports.
Every Thursday night for several years, a prominent comedy club in Miami is entirely sold out, thanks to this man.
Buenas noches! ¿Cómo están?
George Harris is probably the most successful Venezuelan comic nowadays. His audience is not only in Miami, where many Venezuelan immigrants live, but also...
¿De dónde vienen? De Madrid, qué chévere.
From Madrid, Amsterdam, Ohio, New Jersey, people travel from all over the world to see his stand-up routine, which is inspired by the struggles of Venezuelans and how they compare to first world's problems.
Venezuelans, sometimes we have no water, no power. We have problem with violence. And here the problems are that people, you know, want to change gender or want to send your kid to Boston to study in the best university of the world. And that's the distance between two different worlds, you know.
Harris is part of a generation of comedians who experience Venezuela's economic collapse and increasing repression. And they find inspiration in adversity.
¿Cuántas veces no estaba uno en una fiesta y de repente la gente baila? Ya va, espera, déjame ver. Y se asomaba al balcón, tal carro.
Like a couple at a party having to constantly dance their way to the window to check if their car is still there.
Que en una de esas... ¡Coño, se llevaron el carro!
These comedians joke about hyperinflation, food shortages, hospitals falling apart, and how people adapt to these problems in creative ways.
It's not that we have to be a victim or we have to just cry in this stage and say, oh, you know, we are just a poor little thing. No, it's talking about real things, making jokes.
Close to a third of the Venezuelan population left the country over the past decade, and among them, many comedians. They now fill venues of all sizes across Latin America and Spain, where most Venezuelans have migrated. Estefania León, a young Venezuelan comedian in Mexico City, never thought she would be able to joke about so much tragedy.
Nos fuimos... perdidos, molestos, con una situación muy difícil encima, económica, social.
She says she left Venezuela feeling lost and angry.
Nos hizo como entrar en una especie de rechazo de quienes éramos.
At one point, she was rejecting her Venezuelan identity. But gradually, she was able to transform those feelings into humor.
El cambio viene, y viene ya. ¡Gloria al Bravo!
León is one of three producers of El Cuartico, or The Little Room, a weekly video sketch streaming on social media. One of their most famous episodes is named Living Cheaply in the U.S. is Possible.
Vivir barato en el corazón de la ciudad de Miami es posible.
Here, León plays a Cuban realtor in Miami who's trying to convince immigrants to rent a car trunk as a home for $2,500 a month. Another episode features a drunk authoritarian man who won't leave a party that finished hours ago. They're mocking President Maduro's refusal to give up power. Many comedians abroad, like George Harris, can't return to their homeland.
They're looking for me. If I go back, they take me to jail. They will do something to me.
Harris is facing an arrest warrant for allegedly promoting hate, and he hasn't been to Venezuela for over 10 years.
When you make someone laugh, you open the heart. And that's the power that we have with the people. That's why dictators, they don't like comedians, because they have more power than them.
Most Venezuelan comedians work and live outside their country and are free to say whatever they want. But the ones in Venezuela have to be much more careful.
Oh, yeah.
Carluis Medina performs in Caracas.
El problema es que no se puede hablar claramente porque...
He says comedians there can't speak clearly about anything political because you can become a target of the government. In recent months, after Venezuela's controversial presidential election, Carluis had to cut nearly all political references from his comedy routine. He did go on tour visiting smaller cities across Venezuela.
El público lo que decía era gracias por venir. Para acá no viene nadie.
He says the public would thank him for coming where no other comedian had come in years. And this is why he wants to remain in Venezuela.
Grandes comediantes tuvieron que irse y el público quedó un poco desamparado aquí.
Because, he says, people there also deserve to laugh. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Everybody needs to find their people, which probably explains the popularity of an open mic night where Chinese language speakers get together for a mix of stand-up comedy, political activism, and group therapy. The World's Matthew Bell recently caught one of their events in New York.
It's not easy to get a ticket. As soon as a new date is announced, these open mic events sell out right away. They take place at different venues around New York City. This one's in the auditorium of a grade school on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And they're organized by a group called Nuzza Juyi.
So if you translate it literally, it means feminism.
That's producer Vicky Wong, who worked on this story with me, and we're talking during the intermission. Vicky is a Chinese-speaking stand-up comic herself, who's also performed at one of the open mic events organized by Nuzza Juyi.
However, they swapped out one of the characters, so instead of ism, it means ideas. So it's women's ideas rather than straightforward feminism, but the pronunciation is the same.
The audience is mostly women in their 20s and 30s from across the Chinese-speaking world, Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China. The theme of today's show is behind closed doors, and it includes a fun interactive component with those in attendance, as Vicky explains.
All the performers are sharing secrets that they're keeping for their family, in their family, and during intermission, they're sharing this QR code so that audience members can scan it and then share a secret that they no longer want to keep anonymously with the whole room.
Liang Xiaowen is sharing a story about the time state security agents came to visit when she still lived in China. She said her parents worried the men were there to question her dad. But then her mom said to Liang, with some relief, "Oh, the security people are here for you." Liang tells me on Zoom the incident was from 10 years ago, and it took a long time to get to the point where she could laugh about it.
I was like super scared when that happened. It affected me and my family. Can you imagine, like, you were a closeted lesbian, your dad called you saying that, like, the police were there talking about your activism work. So that scared the shit out of me.
The authorities in China know how to intimidate people, Liang tells me. She says she can't imagine sharing a story like this publicly back home in China, where freedom of expression is limited. But the open mic provides an opportunity to do so.
We have a stage that's designed for us. By us, I mean Chinese-speaking women, queer, marginalized people who speak both, you know, Chinese and English, and who are still deeply connected with what's going on back home in China.
Liang helps organize Nuzza Juyi events, and like pretty much everyone who participates, she uses a stage name when she performs. There are also some pretty strict rules, as another organizer explains to me. She goes by the stage name 997 and says she doesn't want her picture taken.
No camera, no recording.
And why is that?
It's just because we talk a lot of like sensitive issue that will definitely get censored, like in Chinese word. That's why we ask, like, no confidential, everything happens here stays here.
Another performer who goes by the initials LP says she has mixed feelings about not identifying herself.
It's a little bit sad for me to not using my real name, to be honest, but if like people connect your face and your name, there could be potential risk that they can find your family back in China, and we all have people that we care about.
The humor and commentary here gets a little salty at times. There's stuff about sex, sexuality, along with lots of jokes about the news, family, and relationships. And this is a reminder of what the Chinese open mic is all about. Wang Yaqiu is a fellow with the University of Chicago's Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression.
First of all, it's fun. It's entertainment. That's, you know, why it attracts a lot of people. I'm a researcher for women's rights issue in China for over a decade. It is depressing. But I think this open mic, first of all, you know, it's comedy.
Similar Chinese language open mic events are happening in other U.S. cities, Washington and Los Angeles. Wang says they've been around for a few years and seem to be getting more popular. A new concern, she says, is the political atmosphere here in this country for visa holders and undocumented immigrants under the Trump administration.
You know, if you're not a citizen, you're not even a green card holder, like you wonder whether if I make a joke about Trump, even in a bar, in a club, would that affect my visa status? Would my visa be revoked?
Wang says this all makes her worry. But as one stand-up performer told me, if anyone knows how to handle a repressive political environment with courage and good humor, it's members of the feminist community from China. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, New York.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to our 4th of July special, all about stand-up comedy, an American invention being embraced across the globe.
We're going to hear now about a comedy series that attempts the impossible, making people laugh about climate change. It started in the UK in 2023.
Human-caused climate change is fundamentally changing the fabric of the weather as we know it.
Translation, weather used to be clouds. Now we've made it into a sort of Rottweiler on steroids that wants to chew everyone's head off.
We have solutions. Renewables are now much cheaper than oil and gas, as well as less polluting.
Wait, what in the renewable wind-powered is stopping us?
That's climate science translated, where an actual climate expert speaks the way a scientist does before a comedian swoops in and translates it to funny. The online video series has been so popular in Britain that a pilot for an American version just dropped here in the U.S.
Let's make this climate crisis a climate crisisn't.
The comedian there is David Cross, a.k.a. Tobias, on Arrested Development. His expert, Princeton University climate scientist Michael Oppenheimer.
These unprecedented weather events are already occurring at 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. Most scientists anticipate we're heading for 2 degrees at the very least, if not 3 degrees. So what we're seeing today is just the beginning.
If the difference between 1.5 and 3 doesn't sound like a lot, it's because we need new numbers. Totally dead? ?
Before we send you off to enjoy your fireworks and hot dogs this 4th of July, let's listen back to my interview with the creators of Climate Science Translated, Nick Oldridge and Ben Carey. We chatted about the project back when it was first getting off the ground. So let's start with you, Nick. I've noticed in the past decade or so that climate scientists have actually gotten more confident and better at speaking in plain, accessible language about climate change. Why do you think this translation is still necessary?
Well, hi. Yeah, no, I think they might have done, but they're still probably speaking to the same group of us who are tuned into the environmental issue. And I think what struck me was it just seemed to be me and this small group really focused on this, getting more and more concerned as more and more time goes by. And then the large majority completely oblivious. I can trace it back to a ski trip I do with some really old college friends when I suggested to them one year, guys, maybe we shouldn't fly to the Alps. Why don't we take the train or the electric car? And they looked at me like I was slightly mad and started calling me Greta. So then I thought there's a problem here. These guys are not reading what I'm reading. So we need to rectify that some way.
So the idea is to broaden the audience of who is hearing these messages. Ben, why turn to comedians specifically?
Well, I think the idea is, first of all, to use messages that people want to listen to. You know, no one likes a lecture ultimately, but you know, if you're being told you're going to listen to a comedian, you might enjoy it. So I think that's at one level what we're doing. And then the other important thing I think is it's not just playing it for laughs, is that comedians are allowed to tell it like it is. You know, they can cut all the nonsense and distill stuff to the real kind of truth of the matter in language that, you know, they have more license to say what they want than almost anyone else. So we found that also quite useful for the crisis we're dealing with.
All right, we've got another clip from another of your videos, scientist Bill McGuire and comedian Kiri Pritchard-McLean.
Most of us by now are aware we're facing a climate crisis, but perhaps not the full scale and urgency of it. Over the last 200 years, the global average temperature has risen by roughly 1.3 degrees centigrade, which sounds relatively modest, but is already leading to an explosion of extreme weather events.
Quick translation, half the world is flooded and the other half is a bonfire. And it's still early days.
So what we heard there is obviously, you know, an exaggeration. Half of the world flooded, the other half a bonfire. Ben, scientists are super careful about how they communicate what they know. They're very careful to never get ahead of the data. So how have they felt about having their messages summed up like this in kind of potentially exaggerated punchlines?
Yeah, you would never get a scientist saying that line. And in fact, you know, part of the fun here is that the professor says something very kind of, you know, carefully scientific and in line with the data. And then the comedian just kind of rips it apart and exaggerates it for comic effect. But we did, having said that, we did check what the comedians were saying back with the scientists.
Have they reacted in a way that, you know, this is liberating to be able to hear their messages put in this kind of way?
I think they want to be able to communicate very clearly the urgency of this. But the paradox is if they really go beyond the scientific language too much, they're not credible anymore. So in a way, they need help, which is what the project is about.
I'm speaking with Ben Carey and Nick Oldridge, two of the people behind the climate comedy video series, Climate Science Translated. Nick, attitudes about climate change are changing. They have been changing. Are you noticing that more people are getting it?
They're definitely changing. But I think we're dealing with a numbers game, aren't we? So time is running out for our window for dealing with it. So we need numbers, and we need the numbers of people shouting and using all their agency in whatever part of society they come from. And so that is a public information problem. It's a communication problem. So I was just a regular guy thinking, I can't do much to impact this. But I looked at money that I was planning to leave to my kids and thought, well, this won't exist in the future if we carry on our current path. So I do need to do something. And it was all based on me thinking it's shifting, but it's just not shifting fast enough, and we don't have the time to wait now.
We've got another clip now from comedian Jonathan Pye translating for Joanna Haig, Emeritus Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London.
Historically, fossil fuels are responsible for about two-thirds of emissions, but the fossil fuel industry lobbies strongly against cuts. In fact, it's getting governments to grant new licenses for even more exploration, more oil and gas.
When you're in a hole, stop digging. That's the proverb. Not dig even more to maximise profits until the whole planet is doomed and you can go live in your bunker.
I love that one. It puts a very fine point on it. So we're talking climate comedy. Do either of you know any climate change jokes?
No, is the answer. Mm. This is Ben. It's actually quite tricky to find jokes and the right level of humor that not only makes you laugh, but also makes you want to act.
We leave it there today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Happy 4th of July, everyone. Whatever you do, keep laughing.
And join us back here for the latest news on Monday. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Let me take it again. I feel like my mouth muscles are going.
It's early.
Okay, go ahead. Here we go. Laugh like. Come on. Pop up screen. Go away. Go away. Pop up screen. Go. Come on. We'll get there. We're almost there.
Almost there.
This is The World. One more time. Okay. Here we go.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.